saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Today on The Grave Talks, the house that once stood at 207 in Watervliet. Sometimes a property can just speak to you. Sometimes a property can speak to two different people in two very different ways. One may find a property enchanting, very intriguing, welcoming, warm, and home-like for reasons beyond their comprehension. Someone in the very same room may find the property disturbing, odd, uncomfortable, for reasons, again, beyond their comprehension. What happens when the two very different feelings collide and that home ends up becoming their residence? That's what we're going to hear about today on The Grave Talks. We're talking with Jill Marie Morse about her experiences at a home with the number marking 207 in Watervliet. Jill, take us back to that very first time you found this property.
It was three flats in an old Victorian house that was built in approximately the mid-1800s. And three families lived in it, which were down on the first floor, a family very long term had been there until actually the house was taken down. Then we lived on the second floor, and there was an older woman who lived up on the third floor. Now, when we first were shown the house, I was married about a year and a half, and I was 5 months pregnant. We were trying to get organized to really be closer to both of our jobs, and also take advantage of the fact that our very good friend lived right next door to 207 19th Street. So she ran a daycare, so it was very convenient and kind of comforting, if you will. But from the start, when this house was mentioned, even though I'd been over to our friend's countless times and I knew the house was there, I, even before we went to look at the house, was picking up on something, which was I started having some really bizarre dreams pertaining to the house, and they seemed to be sequential and they seemed to escalate. And meaning that it was like one night they would be one thing, it would be pretty intense, and then the next night it would be a little, it was almost like a reveal, I guess is a good way to explain it.
But a dream can just be a dream. A dream can stem from anxieties. A dream can easily stem from things that are not necessarily paranormal. Are dreams something that one should base their life decisions on? Let's talk about the dream and what it revealed to you.
What it was my husband. It was very strange. It was like something was going on with him. And each part of this dream that progressed over, you know, some time, several days, he changed in the dream. So it was like I was taking part of it, and in the final part of the dream, it actually was very foreshadowing of what took place. It was slightly different. It was basically being in a car with him, and there was this huge explosion. Now, with keeping that tucked in your back pocket for future reference, we did have an incident with a car, and then later on that following August with a boat that was very similar to what transpired in those dreams. So we went to go look at this flat, and, you know, 5 months pregnant, I wasn't, you know, feeling too terrible, but I, you know, took my time going up the stairs, and I remember this vibration, this shock that just went through me as soon as I put my hand on the banister going up the stairs, and I almost fell backwards. It startled me, and I was like, this is just not good. And I was concerned being pregnant, going into a situation like that. Nobody seemed to have any information on the house when I asked, because I had this very negative feeling about it. And structurally, to look at the house, it was the biggest house down on the lower end of 19th Street. It was very well maintained. It was blood red. And it was just there was something negative about it that I couldn't shake. So I gave it a chance. We walk into the second floor flat, and there were all hardwood floors. And immediately, you walk into the dining room, and I looked down, and I was like, what the heck is going on here? There were footprints, very old floors, but very, you know, polished, but there were stains in the dining room leading from the living room into the dining room. Of old, all I can say is they look like old nursing shoes, like a block heel. They were definitely feminine, female shoes, and smaller size, but I was like, that's really interesting. Why is there stain, very dark stain, footprints coming in from the living room? But when we went into the living room, that's kind of where the biggest red flag had always been, which was immediately from a floor perspective, the floors were completely, like, for the most part, stripped. There was one spot to the left that was really roughly done. It hadn't even been finished, and I thought that was extremely odd. It was like a large circle area that somebody had even buffed out even more and had left it there. And there were some items that were left from the former tenant that I thought were odd. But the haze in that room, and I always describe it as a haze. People have been there, have described it as well as a haze. And I don't want to say it was like oppressive, but it was odd. For anybody that went upstairs into our flat, that living room was the brightest room in the house. It had the most light for the longest period of the day. It was very open and large, but it was, from the sense of the haze, it was negative. It was very different from the rest of the house. But everybody always commented, like, what, you couldn't smell anything, but you could physically see something that just didn't look right. It's almost like, you know, when you get a fingerprint or a smudge on a glass and you look through it and it's somewhat fuzzy, that's kind of what it looked like. It was never clear, even on a day where we had the windows open. It just seemed almost like stagnated in there. I can't explain it. So that was odd.
Being sensitive to things, sights, scenes that others may not be, is nothing really new for Jill, though. She has a long history in her family of being sensitive to the other side.
So at a very young age, my grandfather died just before my second birthday. And apparently, as the story goes, and I vaguely remember this confusion, I was confused why they were telling me he was dead, as much as you can tell a two-year-old. And he was coming to me. So it was very confusing, to the point where my paternal grandmother had said, Jill, Poppy's dead. And I was saying things, you know, Poppy's over there and whatever. And she called my other grandmother, who was also very intuitive, a psychic medium her life. And she said, I think Jill's got your gifts, because she's talking about her husband, my grandfather, being in the room, and he's not there. He's dead. So my grandmother was concerned, but at the same time, she knew my other grandmother had this history of abilities. So in time, there were things that happened as I got older. My other grandmother, she mentored me. She would watch me and ask me questions age appropriately, teach me different things to protect me. She's part Native American, well, mostly Native American. Her and her sister were taken away from her mother at a very young age and put in a Catholic orphanage. So being raised Native American and then being put in a Catholic orphanage, they had to adapt to the Catholic religion. So she grew up kind of using both what she learned in Catholicism as well as incorporating her Native American upbringing. So that's kind of what she did with me relative to the gifts, because my great-great-grandmother was full-blooded Chippewa, great-great-grandfather full-blooded Seneca Indian, and my great-great-grandmother Gertrude was the tribal medicine woman. They migrated down from Canada, and apparently she was an astute psychic medium. My great-great-grandmother, not my great-great-grandfather, but so basically it's hereditary. So my grandmother was teaching me different things like this. As far as the house, the sense went, I was so young at that age, newly married at 21, pregnant at 23-ish, and I had never encountered, despite how much my grandmother had taught me, mentored me with my abilities, I had never encountered anything so dark. So I was relaying information to her, and she was actually a couple times remotely reading the house, and she said, "Jill, I don't like this. Is there any way you can find another place?" She flat out said, without even seeing the house. And I said, "Graham, something's wrong here." And I argued with my husband. You know, I said, "I've talked to Graham, and she even agrees this isn't a good idea." And it was an argument, actually. And I just kind of gave in. I'm like, "I'm not going to win this. You know, sensibility says our neighbor's going to watch the baby while I'm working, while he's working. It's good to have somebody so close to the house to have this work out. We're closer to our job." So I just kind of, I gave up arguing over it. One of the biggest mistakes of my life.
Would you say that your husband was drawn to the house, or was it more so just the convenience factor of everything that was nearby?
I think it was a little of both, actually. I've thought about that many times, and people have asked me. People that know him or knew him also said the same thing, that, you know, part of it was convenience. It made a lot of sense financially and otherwise. Yet at the same time, when our closer friends knew that this was an argument, that I did not want to move into this house, I was telling him of when the dream started. Walking through the house, I knew there was a spirit of a male in there right away, and I blocked him because I knew it wasn't good. It was really tough, and they, friends, would say, "You know, he's just, you know, I get it. You know, if you're picking up on something and you don't think this is going to go well and you're bringing a baby into the house, you know, maybe I can talk to him for you." And he wouldn't budge. And he was totally intent on moving in there. So, like I said, it was just, I gave up.
Giving up, compromising, whatever you may want to call it at that given point in time and in one's life. They eventually did move in to the property at 207 to continue on with their life.
That sequence of dreams ended right after moving into the house, and it ended with a terrible tragedy, which was this huge explosion. My husband with the car, he wanted to kill me in the dream, and I'm like, "What the heck?" I, you know, I'm having so many different emotions. I'm pregnant. I'm having impressions about the house. You know, so there's a lot going on, and it just stopped for me at that point, and I just knew I had to incorporate a lot of, if you want to say, spiritual defense, spiritual warfare, because I knew something wasn't right. Now, he, on the other hand, laughed about it. He would tease me about it. Initially, so we moved in late spring, early summer, and by the 4th of July, there was a party at our neighbors next door, and one of our good friends slept on our couch so he wouldn't have to drive. And he had an experience that was rather unusual, and my husband teased him about it, which was, he had a dream, and he was freaked out, that a man came and got him while he was sleeping on the couch and tried to push him off the couch towards the window, because we were up on the second floor, and he was really rattled about the whole thing. And at breakfast that morning, my husband teased him, and I was like, "It's not funny, Jim." I said, "This is, you know, something's wrong with this house." So our friend was unnerved by it, but, you know, whatever, you know, chalk it up as they were having a good time the night before, maybe had a little too much beer, whatever, sleeping on a couch. So then it was actually on the 4th of July, because that was a day or two before. On the 4th of July, we were coming from a picnic, and his personality, it was a slow change with him, but it was consistent and it was bizarre. So, you know, a month and a half or so, here we are in the house. We're driving back from the 4th of July party at a location, and out of nowhere, he just, I can't even explain it. I'm sitting in the front seat, and he snapped, and he literally started driving the car down the middle of the road towards a truck towing a boat. And I will never forget. I was hysterical, and he was laughing, and everything changed about him. And a lot of people will say, oh, right. No, his affect changed, his mannerisms changed, his speech changed. It was bizarre. And so the police did come, because it ended up, fortunately, he did not run straight into him because the truck managed to veer away. But at the same time, it caused an issue. And even the police were like, what is going on? He wasn't drunk. They couldn't, you know, there was nothing they could do as far as with him drinking. So it was just strange. And it was something we talked about. He just said, you know, I don't know, I just did it. And then at one point he said he couldn't remember it. And that's where I started talking to my mom, who's a registered nurse. And I said, listen, he did something so bizarre. I said, something's not right. And as time progressed, that behavior also progressed. In August, when I was due for the baby, we were on a boat, just kind of having a nice relaxing day with friends, and they were pulling the kids around on the tubes in the back of the boat. And he got behind the wheel and just started driving the boat, just almost like he did with the car that day, which was recklessly, extremely reckless, to the point his friend, the kids were screaming, we were screaming in the back of the boat, I was holding on for dear life, here I am pregnant, and it took our friend to get him away from the wheel, because he could have killed the kids easily with what he was doing with the boat. It was bizarre. And he, on the way home, he was very quiet, and he did not seem to remember that. He did not seem to recall what happened. It was just an instantaneous, weird type of situation. So, you know, everybody was concerned, like, because he was a very fun-loving, loved kids, loved family. He would never, on a normal day, do anything like that. So, heading into the fall, we had a lot of paranormal activity in the house. Some of it's mentioned in 207. Some of it I did not mention until Saints, because there was one thing. There was random, really bizarre knocking that we would hear in the living room, which is where that the haze was. There were two doors you could go into the living room from the hallway. And I remember going to answer the door a couple times and nobody was there. And I would say, my God, I said, what am I losing it? Because I'm hearing somebody knock on the door. Well, this one time, my mom was over. She heard it. And I was like, don't even open the door. I said, there must be something going on, meaning pipe-wise. There must be something going on. We're not expecting anybody. It's the same knocking and the same door. So it was always the living room door. So I basically kind of just dealt with that. But then one night my husband heard the knocking, and literally you would go out in the hallway and it was confusing because you would swear somebody was at the door. And he even said the same thing. That's so weird. But we would have, my mother gave us a wooden carving, beautiful wall decoration that would not stay on any of the dining room walls. You could put it on any other wall, but it wouldn't stay on the dining room wall. It would come crashing to the floor. After several times moving it around in the dining room, which is where I wanted it, it was, you couldn't repair it. I had an incident where I was ironing. Everything was fine, and it was not the iron. We didn't have another problem with the switch or with the plug, but sparks literally flew out and caught my shirt from the bottom of the iron, caught my shirt on fire. And I literally ran in and threw the iron into the sink. he would have, my husband was having some bizarre nightmares. Our friend came over again and spent another night on the couch. He was dating my friend. And he had another nightmare, very similar, he said, to the, and he was at that point, he said, I don't know. He goes, I don't think it's me. He goes, I think it's the house. And Jim would consistently make fun of anybody that had mentioned any kind of strange feeling. And I was asking my our friends, and I was asking around, do you know any history here? Downstairs neighbor wouldn't talk. I thought that was a little strange. Nice man, but he wouldn't talk about the history of the house. And I was just convinced, I knew there was at least one male spirit in our apartment. And there was something very different about his essence, I guess. So rather than talk about it in the apartment, I talked about it like with our neighbors outside, and just did what I could. His behavior relative to my husband, by November, we had an odor. We came home from work and walked upstairs, and as we were walking upstairs, you could smell it. It did smell, to be completely honest with you, it smelled like a dead animal. And we're like, what the heck is going on? And it was right before my son's baptism, which was November 27th. So what ended up happening was we couldn't find anything. It just kept getting stronger. It was horrible. We turned off the heat. It used to be Niagara Mohawk at the time this happened. Now it's National Grid. Called them. They ended up, everybody had to leave the house because it was very evident there was this horrific smell permeating. It, like I said, we could smell it going upstairs, but once we were in the apartment, it was just, it took over the whole house. So they tagged the furnace thinking it was an issue. 2 days, they looked into it. They called us and said everybody can go back because all three families had to leave. And they never found the cause. And we thought it was a dead animal possibly in the wall. And they said no, because it just got, it was bizarre what happened. And even Niagara Mohawk said the same thing, that they could not trace where it was coming from. It seemed to be coming from the basement at one time up into our apartment. And then other times it seemed to be focused in the apartment. So that, you know, that legitimately happened and was very strange. It was my husband's behavior the day of the baptism. I look now with hindsight after everything happened, and we have pictures. I posted pictures on the website. There's a picture of him, and he looks very upset. And it's the day of our son's baptism. He's very, his mood is very dark. He fought tooth and nail for some strange reason, did not want, at the last minute, our son to be baptized. Our priest thought it was strange. He was in a foul, foul mood the entire day. He left halfway through the, after we had a party at a restaurant, he left. He was just acting very strange. And Christmas, the only time I had seen an apparition in 207 occurred on Christmas Eve going into Christmas morning, because it was really late by the time we got the tree up. I went to make tea and came out, and when I stopped, and Jim was sitting on the one side of the living room, and when I stopped and went in, I immediately saw it. I wouldn't say it was a priest with a collar, but it looked like a priest. It looked like an old-fashioned, like Victorian type of looking priest. And I knew he did not have the same affect that a normal priest would have, which was very disconcerting to me. I remember thinking, this is not a priest. I'm seeing a priest, but this is not a priest. This is very evil. That lasted just, I didn't say anything to Jim when I saw it, because he was acting crazy enough, and I didn't want to say anything that was going to disturb him. So I just observed, and I kind of looked down, and I kept remembering, praying to myself that, like, this is not normal. This is not normal. And he was standing right, the apparition appeared right in front of our Christmas tree. And I said, this is just really, this is bizarre.
When your husband began to act strangely and out of character, was this something that would overtake him for long periods of time, almost as if slowly transforming into someone else, or initially did it go in small bouts and small doses?
No, it was bouts. And talking to my mom, talking to his family, you know, we're like, my gosh, does he have a mental illness? And my mom tried to get him to go see a psychiatrist. By the way, there are YouTube interviews. There are four. They're long, but they cover a lot of ground with my mother, because my mother went through this with me. And as a registered nurse, you know, she's dealt with these things before. And she even says, you know, you couldn't figure out, she goes, it didn't fit anything she was accustomed to dealing with. And that's why she's like, Jim, you've got to go see somebody. Something's wrong. He would be fine. And then, you know, for the most part, he would be fine. But there was something agitating him consistently. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was like there was an undercurrent with him. And then sometimes it would just come out, and it was so bizarre to see. And he just refused. When his behavior started getting really bad, like around Thanksgiving-ish, going into Christmas, and it was all downhill from there, I was starting to do things like really aggressively to combat this negativity that was going on in the house. Most of the time, if he was out of the house, he seemed okay. There were times when he was out that he was not okay, but he seemed to have some type of relief. He did seem at times to be a little more relaxed. We talked to him about that. We were just like, are you happy with the house? His mom would ask him. His best friend would ask him. Oh, no, everything's fine. Everything's fine. But it evidently was not. And I was doing house blessings. My grandmother was instructing me what to do. I was trying to get a hold of our priest to actually come do blessings. And every time it seemed I tried to get a hold of him, Joe, our priest, everything went sideways. It was bizarre. So he never got to the house, but I was doing my own thing. By the time 1989, going into 1989, he was exhibiting very strange behavior going into late winter, spring, which was he was unplugging phones and hiding all the phones, so I couldn't call just couldn't call anybody. He was isolating me, and he was showing up just doing random things, like he'd leave work and come across the bridge and show up at home when I was home on a weekend. Then he'd go back. He'd come. It was very bizarre. Like, I'd go to my grandmother's and he would call my grandmother's. It was very strange. And he started to become violent towards me physically in spring, which was, there was one point that I describe in 207. I will never forget this. We were talking and things kind of went sideways, and I went into the kitchen, and I remember coming back out to go talk to him, and he was sitting on the couch, and he had taken his grandfather's shotgun and was sitting with the shotgun between his legs pointed up at his head. And I was like, oh my God. And all I knew is I had to get the baby and get out of the house, because I knew if I finished walking in, a number of things could have happened. So I went, I was in my bare feet, and it was freezing rain. It was, I think, February, March-ish. And I grabbed my son out of the crib, went down the back, out the back door, down the back stairs, and ran to our neighbors. And I said, Jim's sitting in the living room with a gun between his legs. So the Waterville police came. They took the gun. They were going to take him to be evaluated, but he seemed appropriate when they interviewed him, other than he said he didn't know why he was sitting there like that. They did take the gun, and I stayed with my friends. I didn't go home that night. I was too afraid. So that was kind of like, it was weird things he was doing. He would make fun of people that would have like some type of misfortune. If like somebody fell and somebody had broken their arm or their elbow, and he thought that was incredibly funny. And we're all looking like, what What is wrong with you? Just like things like that, in addition to the really bizarre behavior changes. And let me see, by spring he had, there was a situation where he came home and he had been drinking. He was bowling and he had been drinking, and I thought it was kind of strange because he normally didn't like have that terrible meanness to him, meaning as far as like after bowling and drinking a couple beers with his friends. But he came home and he was acting bizarre, and I had hid the keys to the car so he wouldn't take the car to go back out. So when he went to go find the keys to leave and he realized I had hid them, he punched me and knocked me out. He hit me really hard, as a matter of fact. So he left. He found the keys and he left. And I filed assault charges on him, and that was it. That he had crossed the line, and I could not put myself or my son in any more line of danger. So I went and I moved across the river to my mom's. He stayed in 207. And he was given supervised visitation only because of the assault and battery charges. And so my mom was the designated supervisee for when he would come to make sure that our son and I were safe. And on the night of June 28th of 1989, it was a planned visitation. Was a little odd because he showed up with two big grocery bags, paper grocery bags, and he had some toys in at least one of them. And he was typical for that time period. He actually asked to take a nap after dinner, which was not normal. And we were kind of skeptical. My mom and I were just like, you know, that's kind of odd, you know, whatever. So he had put the paper bags on my dresser. And he had laid down, and I went back in the dining room with my son, and my mom was doing dishes in the kitchen, and I went to wake him up. I said, you need to get leaving because the visitation's over, and you better give Jimmy his gifts before you go if that's what you want to do. So I turned around and went back into the dining room, and as I was getting my son cleaned up to take him out of the high chair, I could hear him rustling around with the paper bags, thinking, okay, he's getting the toys, all right. And I took my son out of the high chair, turned to my left. I was holding my son in my right, and when I turned, my husband was standing right in front of us with his grandfather's 12-gauge shotgun pointed right at us. And he started saying some really bizarre, nasty things. What he was going to do. He said he wanted to shoot me, or he said he was going to basically shoot the baby, then shoot me, and then shoot himself. And I was hysterical. It was like looking at a different person. I hate to say this because it sounds so dramatic, but it is so true. It's like his whole entire pupils were blown black. His face was weird. He was talking strange. He was mimicking me as I was screaming and begging for him not to shoot us. And I was just like, please, I'll put the baby down. If you're going to shoot somebody, shoot me. Don't shoot the baby. And my mom, over the noise of the water at the other end of her house, knew something was going on. And I could see her come behind him through the door. And she just snapped into her nurse mode and was using a different approach than I was, which was screaming and begging. She was just like very calm and trying to connect with him. And I'm like, what the heck? And as she was talking to him, she was moving forward and came around. And there was about a foot and a half-ish, maybe 2 feet at the most, space between my son and I and the gun. And she just stood. She went right in there and she turned and she faced him and she's like, Jim, you don't want to do this. You love Jill and the baby. And she's just like, put the gun down. And she kept talking to him like that. And at that point I shut up because I'm praying to God. I'm like, this cannot be happening. And I'm just looking at my son like, ugh. Anyway, so for a split second, it took her a while, but he connected to what she was saying, and he didn't put the gun down on the floor. He just put his arm down with the gun in his hand and was, like, looking. Like, it was bizarre. The look on his face was, like, what the heck am I doing standing here? Like, he couldn't even figure out. He looked puzzled. And he didn't say anything, and my mother was like, Jim, it's going to be okay. Give me the gun. And instead, he bolted for the door, and as soon as he was out, my mother barricaded the door, and I called the Troy police. And then a whole pursuit began of where did he go. They had me in the car looking with them to find a place that he may, you know, a familiar place, driving around. They had the entire house covered with police, protecting my mom and the baby. Then they took me back. Nobody could find him. They involved Albany County at that point, not just Rensselaer County. And we got a phone call from his friend's girlfriend, which we thought was kind of a ruse, that it was just for information purposes, because she said, do you know where Jimmy is? And I was like, no. And the police, because they were standing in there listening to my side of the conversation, they were apprehensive, thinking that he put her up to find out information. And so once we realized, because she goes, well, he just called here and he said, tell Jill and the baby I love them, it's over. And so we knew at that point something was going terribly wrong. And she said that phone call took place right before she called us. So it had been a good hour and a half or so, that to 2 hours, that nobody could find him. So then we got a call from the Watervliet Police Department. They called the police, because the police, on their walkie-talkies, it came through that they needed to have a private conversation. So they called our line, talked to the police first, then they talked to my mother, and I knew something was wrong. I demanded to know what was going on, and they would only say, well, we found your husband. And I was like, well, is he okay? And I knew, just by what they told my mom and how she was acting, I knew something was wrong. So that's when they eventually told me a little bit later that he had shot and killed himself. So apparently when he left the house with what he did in Troy, he went over to Watervliet, back to 207. Very intense. I can only tell you that, you know, in interviewing the police, the detective still came over from Watervliet, because they said even though it was an apparent suicide, they still have to close the case as such. And they said, you know, he was in the corner of the living room, and, you know, so on and so forth. And I did not want to go to 207 at all to get anything that was left there that was his. But the landlord had called me at work a couple weeks afterwards and had said that they knew. He was shocked, actually. Phil DeLallo, who was the owner of the building and had been for a very long time with his brother, had said he couldn't believe this had happened again. He was sorry. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, well, 30 years prior to my husband's death, when his brother Joe DeLallo owned the house, one of Joe's tenants shot and killed himself in the same living room. So I was like, this makes sense now, as far as with at least the mail that I kept picking up on. Other paranormal activity that I forgot to mention that is mentioned in the book included, leading up to this point, before I left 207, was the third time Chris, our friend, came to the house to spend the night, was the last time he was totally... We were sleeping in our room, and again, with hardwood floors, you can only imagine noises amplified. So in the middle of the night, Jim and I are sleeping, and we hear this. You would have thought there were 10 people parading through the living room, like stomping. And Jim went running first, and then I went, because we knew Chris was in the living room. And when we got in there, Chris was standing by the window, shaking. And he's like, I'm out of here. He goes, he was like in shock. And my husband made fun of him again. And he said the same thing happened. This man tried to pull him off the couch and push him through the window. Only this time He goes, he woke up just before he went out the window, but he goes, I swear he was right here with me. Now, what was interesting, there was only Chris in the living room, but it sounded like a stampede. That was it. Chris wouldn't come back to the house. That was in March, I believe, of 89. And just around that same time, a little bit, I think it was a little bit before, my best friend's sister, who was also my best friend, Karen, babysat. And when we came back to the house, she was in the kitchen shaking and said that she was physically attacked. She said, I don't want to come back here. I love you guys. I don't ever want to come back to this house. She said she put Jimmy to bed and something pushed her into the chair. And she, this is before there were cell phones, so she couldn't call us to let us know, but she was like hysterical. And she never went back to the house either. And she was also a nurse. So there was, I didn't suffer anything physical like that. I had a dream not too long before the assault happened, whereas this evil-looking hand came in and reached around, and there were flames, and I was grabbed my son out of the crib in the dream, and I was running to get away from this evil thing with flames that was after me and the baby. And I went into, when I woke up, I was like praying and I was like, holy God, this is terrible. And I took the Bible and I just opened it up. And actually, I think it was Psalm 11. I started reading just randomly in my rocking chair and I was just praying and praying and praying. So I'm being very quiet, just doing what I can because I had this nightmare. And simultaneously, Jim has this horrendous night terror. And talk about scaring the living daylights out of yourself, because he was like in bed, but flailing and like screaming. And he said he, like, I didn't even know what to do. It was, I'm recuperating from my own issue and this takes place. But he was very reluctant to talk about it other than he said it was really bad and something was after him. So that was very peculiar that that happened. On the same night, within minutes apart. And so things like that was, that's really what was going on in the house while living there. The activity did continue for a short period of time at my mom's after he died, where my grandmother called our priest and said, listen, I'm taking them and I'm going home up north because until this gets squared away. And our priest told us that he had some information on the history of the house, and he felt that, meaning of 207, and he felt Jimmy could have been oppressed and possessed. And that was the first ever, other than hearing of The Exorcist, which I've never even seen, meaning I cannot get past the first 5 minutes of that movie. I have never heard of possession or oppression until this conversation came up between my grandmother and the priest. So there was, like, after Jim died the first day or two, at my mom's house, she had a big mantle, and there were a bunch of pictures, one of which was our wedding picture, a big 8x10 in a beautiful glass frame. And my grandma came down to take care of us, help take care of us, and we're sitting there talking, and I was across from my grandmother and my mom, and I kept seeing this mist come through from the dining room, almost in the path he made right before he killed himself, that when he had the gun in front of my son and I, it was almost in the same exact spot. So I was thinking, okay, I'm seeing things. So then I notice across from me, my grandmother is, she's taking her glasses on and off, and I'm just like, huh, something's bothering her eyes. Not even connecting the two. Totally, because I was, you know, an emotional wreck at that point. And we're sitting there, and I felt, I was like, whoa, something's really wrong. It was like a low pressure system came into the room, is all I can tell you how it felt. And all of a sudden, our wedding picture just crashes out of all the pictures, literally flies on the floor and shatters into a zillion pieces. And that my grandmother, my mother was very upset. I was scared to death. There was this other loud noise. It sounded like a truck hit the back of the house and then went away. And that's where my grandmother first tried calling the priest, and that's the priest divulged that he said that he was aware that there was a lot of strange activity over at 207. He said that the church, 300, you know, right very close to the house, that there was a suicide there. He said he was aware that there were some issues he had heard at the house itself. He also mentioned there was the spirit of a girl that he had heard of, and I'm like, oh my gosh. And he goes, he noted the change in Jim, and he said, I think he was going through some type of oppression or possession, with hindsight, obviously. So my grandmother blessed the house, but we left. And then when we came back, there was more discussion about that with the priest. And they didn't want me to really know much of anything. My grandmother and Joe had quite a lengthy conversation. And the long and short of it was that he did think, looking back, that there was something going on because of the history. Now, so here I'd been told after that, I didn't talk to my landlord until, our old landlord, until after this happened and the priest is mentioning this. So to hear Phil say at that point, I can't believe this has happened again. I'm like, what is the history of this house? And it was then that I said, I need to find out. There's more to this story, but, you know, at that point in my life, it wasn't going to happen. So as I got older, and I got remarried, I had another son, I always kept things relative to my son who lost his dad by suicide. I always told him the truth age appropriately. I never mentioned suicide until I knew he was old enough to understand it. And it wasn't just me who spoke to him. It was my mom and my best friend and I and my grandmother. And so he actually, at a very young age, he was able to say, he goes, you know, Mom, I always kind of thought that's what it was. I knew something different happened to him. So when they got older, knowing I'm a medium and a psychic, you know, I never got into anything dark. So I kind of kept it, haha, oh, Mom's, you know, picked up on something again. Isn't that weird? It was always kept very light. But there came a time as adults, I said, I've got to write my story. I have to tell this story. I want to look into the history of the house now that I'm able. My kids are grown. I don't want to hand them something. One of the biggest things why I never really said much was I was afraid that they would grow up, especially my son, who lost his dad, that there would be this, oh, your dad was, you know, possessed or whatever. I didn't want him growing up with that. So I said, you know, you guys, I'm thinking of writing this book. What do you think? And they're like, go for it, Mom. And everybody was very supportive. My friends, my family. And I did. And just at the very end of, well, I was trying to figure out how long do I make this book, because I was starting to get into the history side of things. I told my personal story in 207. And at the very end, I said, well, let me call the, they tore down the whole block. Well, all but one house in 1999. And they built a Rite Aid pharmacy right behind the house. So the lot is there, and right behind the lot is the parking lot. Well, the lot is on the parking lot, but the Rite Aid pharmacy is right behind where the house used to be. So I said, I'm going to just call there right before I, you know, end my story, and I want to see what's going on. And spoke to a couple people who said that the pharmacy is very active, and there were some very strange things. They had no idea about the history of the house or even that the house existed. And as a matter of fact, the manager said he was skeptic until going to the store. He was never a believer until he said there just been some things that he cannot explain that had transpired at the store. I interviewed a couple employees.
So what caused all of this activity? What caused people to act so strangely, to take them over? To take over their lives, to take over their personality, and to take over their actions. What was on this property at one point in time? What had taken place to cause such dark, haunting activity? On the next episode of The Grave Talks, we'll continue our conversation with Jill. We'll continue to learn about the history of the area and what to some may appear as a cover-up of some of this information. Join us next time here on The Grave Talks for that conversation. If you like The Grave Talks, be sure to subscribe to our individual The Grave Talks podcast page on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, iHeart, wherever you download your podcast. Press subscribe. And if you really like the show, please leave us a positive review. That helps other folks find the show and helps us grow. Until next time, this is The Grave Talks. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.